With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Up, you pop craze youngsters, and welcome to part two of episode number 48 of Chart Music, January 24th, 1980. I'm back here again with Taylor Parks.
Hello.
And Simon Price.
Hi.
Shall we get stuck into it, chaps? Let's not fuck about.
Hey ho, let's go.
All right then, pop craze youngsters, it is time to go back to January 24th, 1980. Always remember, we may coat down your favourite band or artist, but we never forget, they've been on Top of the Pops more than we have.
30 seconds earlier, and I could have been on Tomorrow's World. As it is, it's Top of the Pops, hello.
We're immediately thrown into a cold open of tonight's host. Mike Reed is back.
Yeah.
At least he's actually bothered to work out a line. Right, he's got a little joke.
I've noticed that about him, that he does sort of script his links, unlike, you know, DLT just sort of wings it or whatever. They're not good links. They're not funny. They often don't even mean anything. But you can tell he sat down and written them. So I'll give him that.
Yeah, he says 30 seconds earlier, I could have been on Tomorrow's World. Yeah, well, I was thinking, mate, if your dad had pulled out 30 seconds earlier, we'd all retrospectively owe him a pint. Well, that's just not how things turned out.
But yeah, it's not a joke, is it? He says it with his slight kind of droll wobble of the head, you know, as if he's imparted a nice little witticism, but it doesn't work, you know. He's glib and smooth in his delivery, but he gets away with not actually having any material as such.
Yeah, it's nice that he's still new enough to look like he's trying, and it's not like when DLT shows up in the 80s and he's basically scratching his bollocks and yawning while he's introducing the act, but... Unfortunately, Mike Reed trying is almost worse than Mike Reed on autopilot. You know what I mean? Mm. It's like he's doing his best, and that's the saddest thing of all. This is it. This is the peak of a man's life. And it's a bit embarrassing to see how pleased he is to be up there, you know, for no reason, just wasting everyone's time. And looking ghastly, by the way.
I'm going to disagree with you on that, but okay.
You think? I mean, he's got that stark black and white check shirt on with a cream jacket.
I would have wanted that shirt.
Would wear the shit out of that shirt. I would wear it now, actually, if it fit me. I actually had a shirt a bit like that later on in the 80s, but it was more of a sort of swirly psychedelic chessboard, like a sort of op art Bridget Riley kind of thing. Nice. I would love to wear that now. Unfortunately, I have a neck like a tree trunk, so you just can't get them to fit. But yeah, some people would look at Mike Reed in that
shirt.
You put
it on now and all the lines suddenly turn straight.
Exactly, yeah. Some people look at that shirt that Mike Reed's got on and are going to think Pizza Chef. Or Pete Chef's trousers. But, you know, I think it's a lovely shirt, I've got to say.
No, we know what he's getting out there, don't we? He's down.
Yeah, but would you wear it with a cream jacket? Because it looks, no, it just looks like he's been left out in the air and gone discoloured and crusty around the edges, you know, like the artificial cream on a school donut. Where by the time you got there, it's got a shell on it, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't see him in this era. I didn't see him until a few months later. I hadn't heard of him yet. I didn't see this episode. So when I look at this now, there's something a bit unsettlingly off and different about him. And I couldn't figure out what it is. And it's that he's not wearing glasses.
Yeah, you
know when you see somebody who's always got glasses or sunglasses or something on and they haven't got them on, they just look really wrong. Mm. And there's no sort of physical explanation for why that would be the case because they've still got a face with normal eyes. It's just that somehow that it looks like they've had something sucked out of them or whatever. You know, it's just it's kind of wrong.
It's his weak mole eyes. Squinting into the light. I mean, it's like, all right, so you're vain and myopic, right? But what is this? The days when contact lenses were like a Pyrex dish you had to hammer onto your eyeball, you know? I mean, what's his problem? I don't know. I don't like to see it. It's like he's stumbling around like Velma, you know what I mean? Like he comes face to face with an escaped tiger and pats it on the head and says, nice doggy. I mean, it's horrible. He looks like he's been shaken awake after 3 hours sleep.
It's a bit like the old joke, you wouldn't hit a man with glasses, would you? And then you take off the glasses and then hit them, you know?
Now, no one needs those pinhole peepers. Peering out of the telly. Put your fucking bins on, man. Yeah. Get a nice, colourful pair that express your personality.
Yeah,
that and your blue shorts, you'll still attract all the classiest ladies.
We're going to come to that, yeah.
Maybe you dropped the Tomorrow's World reference just to make sure he actually wasn't on Tomorrow's World.
He walked into the wrong studio, Al, right, you're the expert. You're the Top of the Pops expert. You've been on the story of Top of the Pops 1989 more than we have, right?
Yes.
You know the timeline. So I've got to ask, this thing, that green illuminated disc with his autograph on it,
yes,
was that a brand new thing? I mean, I don't recall seeing that in any episodes that we've covered. How long did that last? Was it just for, it can't just be for him for that one night?
Well, as we'll see throughout the show, a couple of other bands and artists get that as well, don't they?
Mm.
As we've discovered when we've covered 1980 in previous chart musics, this is their fucking about period, isn't it?
So they're just trying new things, new production ideas.
This is the beginning of the tinkering era of Top of the Pops,
right?
At this moment in time, Mike Reed is currently holding down the 8 p.m. slot in the week, and tonight he's lodged between Talk About, a regular open forum held in schools where Andy Peebles reasons with the youth on the issues of the day and then plays their requests for Madness and the Police, and John Peel. He's a year and a week away from ripping Dave Lee Travis out of the Breakfast Show throne. In the meantime, he's been enjoying the perks that presenting a Radio 1 show can bestow on a man by wetting his beak in the trough of personal appearances at regional nightclubs. Article in The Stage, mid-1979. As many cabaret venues throughout the country convert their premises into discos, the demand for named disc jockeys has increased considerably. Mike Reed is one of the leading DJs represented by MPC Artists and Management, who report bumper business for all their artists during the summer months. In their experience, the appearance of a well-known DJ at one of the larger venues can sell up to 2,000 tickets in advance. Fucking hell, that's how bereft we were in the Haventers.
Yeah.
But it has to be said, there is a downside to this. As reported by a pop-crazed youngster by the name of Chris, who sent me a series of letters that his partner wrote, the drafts of which he kindly passed on to me. And, this is a while ago, so I've lost your surname, Chris. I do apologise. Make yourself known on social media and you'll be bigged up in the true style and fashion. Imagine the excitement. The year was 1982, and megastar Mike Reed announced he was to make a personal appearance at the Saturday Night Disco in the Kettering Leisure Village, a dilapidated sports hall. The 16-year-old Jill can hardly comprehend the glamour of such an occasion, so prepares a note to hand to Mike should she get a chance. Dear Mike Reed, hi, I'm Jill. Well, this is not a bad disco. Please could you play a record for my friends Emma, Maria, Sue, Alison, Sam, and my boyfriend David? Susie and the Banshees would agree with us. Well, me and David anyway. Ta, Jill. I'm not sure exactly what a live appearance by Mike Reed entails, but I doubt it's going to involve Susie and the Banshees. How did it go? Well, here's the letter of apology she sent to Mike Reed on behalf of the good people of Kettering. Dear Mike, I am writing to you to personally apologise for the pathetic behaviour of certain people who ruined Saturday evening completely. I feel really ashamed and embarrassed that when someone like you takes the time to come to Kettering, we thank you by causing a riot. I really wouldn't blame you if you never come to Kettering again. Anyway, thank you very much for my autograph. I almost didn't have the heart to ask you after all that maybe apology would have been more appropriate. Yours sincerely, Jill. And here's, this is how fucking deep it goes. Here's a letter to her friend Wendy explaining what happened. God, on Saturday, me, David, Maria, Alison, Emma and Sue went to Mike Reed. Boy, I shouldn't think he'll come to Kettering again. There was a load of fighting, ending when the police came and dragged off half the audience. Mike Reed was so disgusted he walked off. He came back on at the end to sign autographs. I got one. He looked really terrible. All yellow and drenched in sweat. Yuck. He looked fed up. And to my knowledge, Mike Reed has never been back to Kettering. Riots at Mike Reed PA. Fucking hell. Wow.
Well, you see, you know, it happened to all these sort of two-tone legends, you know.
Yes,
He's going out there in the world with this message of love and peace and racial unity, but inevitably, the National Front skinheads were drawn to, you know, his sort of jumping up and down, stomping tunes.
Yeah.
And, it's a tragedy. Happened to Jimmy Percy, happened to the Specials, and now it's happened to Mike Reed.
Yeah, he turned up in his madness, modness bad.
Yes.
Yeah. Thing is, if going back to that bit you just read out of the availability of DJs and how much they bumped up the takings of various provincial nightclubs, you think that's tragic. In Barry, right, we didn't even have famous Radio 1 DJs. We had famous Radio 1 DJs' brothers.
Fucking hell! Right?
Yes. Yeah. There was a sort of church hall on Holton Road, the main shopping street, which quite often had a poster outside for a disco held by Vince Saville.
No!
Yeah.
Did you go?
No, I was too young.
Oh.
Actually, maybe I wasn't, hey? But yeah. Jesus.
Younger people don't appreciate this, the cultural bleakness of this time.
They really don't.
I was just thinking, you know, I was comparing Mike Reed's sartorial choices on this episode to the artificial cream on a school donut, and I was thinking that was the dessert for like a salad, which was a heap of carrot shavings, one leaf, a single hemisphere of instant mash doled out with an ice cream scoop, and a little pile of salted peanuts. Right? That was the healthy option.
And yes.
This was the universe within which we experienced Mike Reed,
yeah.
And within which Mike Reed made some colour of sense. You know, this... Mm. These Eastern Bloc conditions under which most British people still lived in 1980, you know, in terms of food, standard of living, the cars people drove and the low-quality goods they had to buy. And so this prick comes on TV and he's basically a rusted-up Austin Maxey, you know. Mm. But in Radio 1 terms, he's the sporty little coupe of the range, you know, of the fleet.
It's a TR7, isn't it?
And we took it because he wasn't a merkin-faced workplace bully or a or a sinewy albino sex offender. Mm. It's like, hey, this guy's cool.
Yeah.
Or off-duty maths teacher.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah, I mean, I liked him.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't, there's no point rewriting history. The heart wants what it wants, you know. Mm. And
he was the cool one.
Yeah, and he had, and I last time we talked about, I think it was episode 20, when we found out that he was called Mickey Manchester in his past. I did like his sort of chortlesome twee style that he had. Mm. And he was a slight, just a very slight shift forwards from the old school DJs of the 70s.
Yeah. Well, he's buttoned his shirt up, hasn't he, for a start?
He has, yeah, buttoned his shirt up to the top without a tie.
Yeah, big mistake.
Well, I don't know, but it makes him look part of the new wave, at least.
Yeah.
And he's got all the badges. The badges are very performative, aren't they? There's so many of them.
Yes.
It's like, it's laying it on a bit thick.
But well, it's a clankening.
A clankening, yeah. I mean, I can't even have a go. I'm sure we've talked about this before, but on my Harrington,
yeah,
or later on my bomber jacket, the idea of not wearing all my badges at once, I just didn't get that. You know, I didn't get that just like one badge can make a huge impact. I would wear every fucking one. And he's doing that.
The one thing that infuriated me about this episode was I could hardly make out any of the badges.
Well, there's madness. There's a madness one.
There's a madness one,
and there's one I think is Kate Bush.
Looks like there's a prisoner one as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he's got some big badges on, which was not the style at the time.
No one cool, was it? They had to be one inch.
No.
But just all these trappings and everything about him, just these little tiny details, made you build a bigger picture in your head that was probably wrong. Well, in fact, we now know it was wrong, but you assumed he was one of the good guys. You assume that, you know, including politically in that, you just assumed, you know, he's name-checking the jam, he's into the specials and madness and all that.
Yeah.
He's kind of, you know, he's on our side. You know, he just thought
exactly
he's on the side of the angels. But, boy, did we turn out to be very wrong about that.
I don't know. I was just listening to his beautiful song about the 2004 tsunami.
What?
You remember that?
No.
Yeah, it got number 4 in the British charts.
Oh, my God.
It was a charity record.
Right. Oh, well,
it was, with what they called One World Project, a pretty, actually fairly impressive supergroup of pensioner rock stars singing Mike Reed's song about the 2004 tsunami, the comfortingly titled Grief Never Grows Old. And it's not a, I have to say, it's not a song that shows too many signs of being the work of an older, more experienced songwriter. It sounds like it was composed on a glockenspiel. But I don't, one thing you can say about it is that it's not as bad as the 2004 tsunami.
Completely passed me by that. Didn't even know that existed.
Yeah, me too.
So when I was preparing for this episode, I remembered that last time we talked about Mike Reed, inevitably there were lots of jokey references to Blue Tulip Rose Reed. You know,
of course there is.
We did, you know, lots of quotes from that. And for people who don't know, it was this documentary on Channel 4 in the 90s called I'm Your Number One Fan about stalkers. And the most eye-catching and memorable character in it was this woman who'd renamed herself Blue Tulip Rose Reed and was a Mike Reed fan, and she's only on the show for about 15-20 minutes out of an hour,
but what 15-20 minutes
exactly
they are.
And I decided, partly because I'll admit I was trying to dredge it for more funny quotes for this episode, but just to sort of get a feel of it, because I haven't watched it for a while, I re-watched it, and it was just way darker than I remember. Obviously the funny bits are still funny in a kind of bleak way, in a way that you feel guilty for laughing, because it's clearly somebody with severe mental health issues, and the program probably wouldn't get made now for exactly that reason. But you know, but you laugh at it, and you watch it in the same way that, you know, if they, you know, you watch something on Live Leaks, or Faces of Death, some really, you know, awful thing that you can't take your eyes away, but you know that on some level you shouldn't be looking at it. So it's like that. So I just thought, for anyone who hasn't seen it, and it is probably out there on YouTube anyway if you want to go looking, but I just want to summarise it for people. So is that okay if I can just go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Well, it starts off, and we see her basically jilling off under the bed covers, and this in itself was obviously kind of pre-planned, and she's going, no, I can't listen to him, it's going straight off, this is how his voice, and then she does a sort of sex noise. And then, And she goes, oh, about meeting him in the Radio 1 car park. This gorgeous-looking guy. I thought, he's an absolute cracker. And then you get the famous, the first really iconic line from it is when she talks about Ed Stewart being there with him in the Radio 1 car park. Ed Stewart's breath stinks. Mike Rita's got beautiful breath. He's gorgeous. He is fantastic. He is tops. He gives it all that. And then Taylor alluded to the blue shorts thing where she slaps his arse and goes, whoa, tenders.
Tenders.
Talk about the electricity going through me and all of that. So that's the kind of meet cute at the start of it, if you like, which it sounds very much to anybody watching it like, you know, it wasn't an accidental meeting. She totally went there to stalk him in the first place. And you know, she does quite a few of these monologues to camera where she's saying, you know, get very emotional, saying, he is everything to me. He's very, very, very precious to me. There is no guy in this world that I've ever loved till I fell for Mike. And then we get this. This is the bit where, and in the last the time we did Mike Reed, Taylor said that she's literally barking mad. This is the evidence of that. She goes, Mike Reed, husband dearest, eat your heart out. And she starts barking, woofing to Mike Oldfield's Portsmouth.
Yes.
It's all of that. She sends him messages going like, when can I get in bed with you? This is when she goes to the print shop. The scene in the print shop is incredible. She goes in, she wants to get a T-shirt made, saying, you know, when can I get in bed with you? And one of the guys behind the counter says, I thought he was gay. And she's like, hey, now you can pack that in as soon as you like.
Yes.
And she breaks down. She starts sobbing. And then we see her on camera, sobbing to the camera, going, I don't mean to cause you any harm. And this is the chilling bit. If I have caused you any harm, I've not meant it. And this just starts getting really dark. And she says this phrase, which it would be a pull quote. If this was a magazine article, this would be, she goes, you have to be a nuisance to get what you want today.
Yes.
And that would be kind of on the film poster or whatever. And she goes, so I'm warning you, viewers, if you happen to fall for a DJ, please be careful. And then it gets to the bit that, seriously, that, you know, you wonder why the cameras are still rolling. But she goes, Mike Reed made me very, very ill and it's put me on these. And she holds out diazepam tablets. And she basically talks about an overdose. She talks about having this failed suicide attempt. And she goes, I've always been lonely because my marriages have never worked out. I mean, marriage is plural. Best will in the world. No. That raises an eyebrow. But then she goes, but Mike's the only one who can cure me because Mike has special powers. Special powers. And then there's the bit, she's on a train station on her way to London and there's a couple of teenagers sort of dry humping each other on a bench on the station.
Yes.
And she pesters them to show them one of her homemade Mike Reed T-shirts and starts cackling wildly. And then they go to the graphologist and also there's this woman who's basically a station manager at Classic FM and they start showing the actual letters that she's written.
Yes.
There's one, it's like, my sweet lips, Mike Reed, I am enclosing you some tennis balls. I cannot wait to play with yours. Will you play with mine? Now will you marry me? Love, Blue Tulip, Rose Reed.
Oh, man.
Fucking hell. And there's another one, there's a typed one, that says, how would you like to find a dead body in your doorway? And then it goes into her suicide attempt in the letter. Then we have a bit of a light relief with a famous washing machine photo.
Of course.
Where she sent in a photo to the station that she has named Mike Reed. And on the back it says, this is to show that I have a washing machine. And there's an envelope, which I think the photo came in, with scrawl on the outside of the envelope, which I paused it, and it says, I badly need your sexy body. And it's got a picture of a cock and bull squirting juice out of it. Here comes juice.
Very bad one, as mentioned before. Absolute amateur.
Yeah, it's not very good, is it? No.
No.
And I've never noticed before, but when you pause it, there's a topless photo of her, dear God.
Yeah.
And we see her typing naked, and then the office manager, Classic FM, starts reading extracts saying, you will know when I am in a temper, I go pure white and shake. And you do sort of feel like it shouldn't have been made, but then she goes to Classic FM, she's actually there, and she's saying, I'm going to a prison camp because everyone there are treated like prisoners. And she's walking through Camden Town, crowing like a cockerel, and she enters, and then here's the prison warder now, and then we have a voiceover from her saying, I don't stalk, I don't believe in it. I've never stalked anybody in my life. So it's this kind of delusional thing. And just the way she says, I changed my name to Blue Tulip Rose Reed, spelt R-E-A-D. She says it quite aggressively like that, you know. And she's talking to the sort of gatekeepers, the office manager in the lobby at Classic FM. And she goes, have you ever known anyone go celibate for the guy they love? And then she pauses and goes, in case you don't know what that means. And they all crack up, laughing and go, yeah, I do, you know. And they say to her, what do you think his girlfriend thinks of that? And she goes, he hasn't got any, but he has now. Me. I'm a jealous woman. I've never hurt anybody. I've never hit anybody, which sounds a bit menacing. And then she goes, I do not come down here every day because I cannot afford to. Which, I mean, this is where there's all this dark stuff, but there are these moments of just pure comedy that you could not have scripted better if you tried. And afterwards, she actually feels great. There's almost this moment of light at the end where she at least feels great for spilling it all out. She feels top banana, and then she's walking away. She's walking away, giving, you know, give me an M, you know, that thing, walking down the street. And that's the last we see of her. But you watch it now, and then you watch this episode of Top the Pops and Mike Reed, and you think, you poor fucker, you might be a UKIP loving, you know, Frankie Goes to Hollywood banning bastard, but nobody deserves that. And, you know, presumably, because, you know, we hear that he did see all the letters. Yeah. It must have been pretty fucking traumatic for him.
In this episode, no spoilers, we don't see a lot of interaction between Mike Reed and the kids.
No.
Fucking hell, no wonder. He's probably quarantined himself.
Wouldn't it be great if, when you look back, every single television appearance that Mike Reed ever made, it's like, okay, pause it there. Right now, zoom in on that bit of the... There she is.
Yeah. One of these members of Legs & Co. are not like the others.
The thing is, wild as she was, I'm not sure Blue Tulip could have kept pace with Mike's real-life love life. Because I was thinking about this, watching this programme, and I suddenly remembered when one of his exes did a kiss-and-tell thing in one of the tabloids. Did you ever see this? Yeah.
No.
And she said that he got her to tie his erection to a bedpost.
What?
With one of her silk stockings. Now, when you stop and think about that, it's really peculiar. It's like a combination of different elements, all of which some people find sexy, but put together in a way that makes no sense at all. It's like she tied his erection to a bedpost with a silk stocking. It's like...
Fucking hell.
You picture that. I mean, I picture that in explicit detail. I would say needlessly explicit, in fact. Like, quite shocking in its frankness. And to me, it's like someone's built a model aircraft with all the right parts, but it's got a wing coming out of the front and like the wheels are on the roof. You know what I mean? It's like, what's he doing there? You imagine this scene with Love is a Wonderful Colour.
Yeah, oh, you bastard.
Drifting across the room.
Yeah, it is a bit like sort of Jeff Goldblum in The Fly, or one of those things where people get teleported, but when they come out the other end, they're all jumbled up.
You know,
all the elements are kind of wrong and they have to redo it.
Just to stop him from sticking his balls in her ear. You know what I mean? It's like, Mike, you're getting it wrong.
We're immediately thrown into a cold open of Mike Reed, standing on a balcony under a green light with his signature etched into it, in black trousers, pale cream suit jacket with a clanking of badges down the left lapel, and an on-trend black and white check shirt, as he drops a Tomorrow's World reference and introduces the top 30 rundown, as we are assailed by the sound of Jazz Carnival by Azimuth. Formed in Rio de Janeiro in 1971, Azimuth were a jazz funk trio who first came to prominence in Brazil when they did the soundtrack to O Fabuloso Fittipaldi, a documentary about Emerson Fittipaldi, and they signed to the American jazz label Milestone soon after. This is a track from their third LP, Light as a Feather. It entered the chart a fortnight ago, and this week it's nipped up two places from number 21 to number 19. So, chaps, this is what Brazilian jazz funk sounds like then.
Okay.
There's lots of this about in 1979-80. Stuff vaguely like this. You had Spyro Gyra, Morning Dance. And a few years later, Mezzo Forte with Garden Party. Mm. And also, there were these LPs that people would often have in their homes, because this was the era where people had just started buying what was then high-end hi-fi equipment. And there would be LPs that you would buy that would be specifically made to show off the dynamic range of that. And they'd be called things like, you know, the sound of stereo or hi-fi sounds or something like that. And it would be light orchestral or sort of cocktail jazz. Like that. And, you know, it's a whole different world, and you sort of can't imagine why people would listen to it for pleasure. The thing with Azimuth is, given their story, their backstory, and their heritage, the fact they were formed in 1971 and they were a Brazilian jazz funk band, I'm thinking that somewhere in their back catalogue, there's got to be some fantastic music. There must be.
But it ain't this.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like an ignoramus for slagging this off, but this tune... Why was this a hit? I don't get it at all.
This came on at the disco. You wouldn't dance to it.
Yeah.
What's its point?
Well, it was the early days of home video, and maybe people needed background music for their, you know, promotional video presentations of their abattoir or, you know. Because this is what it's like. I mean...
I thought you were going to say home videos of tying their erections to the bedpost with a silk stocking as well, you know.
Yeah.
It'd work for that, yeah.
I can't hear this without seeing the words press start flashing on the screen. It's
like... This is the background music on the power boating segments they used to have on Electric Blue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or it'd be on Danger Freaks. Do you remember that, Taylor? That was on Central all the time in the 80s.
No.
It was this documentary that used to trot out every bank holiday about Australian stuntmen.
Oh, yeah.
Had a ridiculous theme tune where this bloke could just go, Danger Freaks! Right at the end after they'd jumped through a hoop of fire or something. And that caught on at our school. We just formed a group called Danger Freaks, and we'd dare each other to walk on the science tables and get from one end of the classroom to the other without falling off or being caught by a teacher. Yeah. And at the end, you had to jump off and go, Danger Freaks!
You're like the original Jackass or Dirty Sanchez or whatever.
Yes.
No, that's what this is like, isn't it? It's that sort of bespoke, unobtrusive jazz funk tinkle that people would commission for this stuff, you know. It's like if you need music that's not going to be listened to, but you haven't got the funds to use library music, people will just get their mate to do it. Do you know what I mean? Like lower than test card music. It's like this is, you would hear, you'd only hear it, football highlights videos, porno films, interlude sequences, or VCR demonstration tapes featuring film of paragliders and brightly dressed skiers. Someone's got a mate who owns his own studio. Oh, he can play anything, you know.
He's got a setting for that.
Yeah, it's a great thing to have done, though, surely, isn't it? Because at least you know that your contribution to this world was actually useful, which must be a nice, peaceful feeling.
And it was exactly the sort of thing which 15 years after this suddenly became very hip, when all those types like the Sound Gallery and, you know, Mike Flowers Pop, something like that, started that easy listen revival. Although I don't recall hearing this Azimuth record on that scene, and I did go to some of those nights, and probably because it's just crap, it's irredeemable, you know.
Well, it's tainted with the musk of disco, isn't it? Even though it's not really...
I mean, it works quite well as a backing for the countdown because, you know, you're not really listening to the song. You're just thinking, oh, fuck this. I'm gonna look at the photos instead.
Oh, yes. And we've got a choice crop this week, haven't we?
I like the Kool and the Gang photo because they're stood next to this posh car that looks like, you know, when you get teenagers standing next to a fancy car that isn't theirs, but they want to make out that it's theirs. I got that kind of feeling from it. Got the skids looking like extras from Blake 7, I thought. Rupert Holmes looking like a young James Whale. The tourists look like a TV director's idea of a new wave band. Like, you know, they've basically been sent to the costume department. Fiddler's Dram, man. Day Trip to Bangor. 12 of the fuckers.
12-piece band, yeah. Good luck with the royalties.
I know, they make Dexys look like Blancmange or something. you've got John Evangelis walking off into the sunset arm in arm. Like, it looks like a remake of Casablanca.
They look like they're about to have a snog, don't they?
Yeah.
It's good to see they've found happiness.
Yeah.
you got a classic cliched photo of the Clash looking hard in a shopping precinct.
Yes.
you got the beat with Saxa looking like he's photobombing them, which he always did, really, to be fair.
Yes.
And then there's a couple of examples of anachronism that slightly bothered me. There's a Pink Floyd one where, and I'm not a huge Pink Floyd, I'm not a Pink Floyd person at all, but there's this picture of Pink Floyd and it's a live shot and they've all got very long hair and it looks quite psychedelic and they're performing under what looks like a sort of projection or a backdrop of this swirly kind of space monster. I thought that's got to be the wrong era because this is the Wall now. This is, you know, a fairly modern time, and I don't know that may be right.
And it's a fucking awful photo.
Lots of awful.
It's like it's been taken by someone at the back of Wembley Arena.
Well, there's lots of very bad live photos. There's one of Sugar Hill Gang, which is a sort of like red.
Oh,
blobs.
That's awful. That's awful. It's like someone's just jogged the camera.
Yeah,
in a nightclub.
Absolutely. Yeah. The other anachronism that bothered me was Booker T and the MGs, where they've got what looks like a very modern era photo for a record that came out in the 60s.
Yeah.
A couple others that jumped out to me were American middle-of-the-road rock acts. There's Styx, where one of the guys in Styx, he's got these white plus fours, sort of like jodhpurs, tucked into gold riding boots. It's quite a look. There's Dr. Hook, who look elated to be alive. And all I'm saying is, if anyone's seen that legendary performance of theirs on German TV, I think that Dr. Hook were elated to be alive quite a lot of the time.
I've not seen that.
Oh, fucking hell. Yeah, it's just basically if you rule out Brian Jones in the Rolling Stones We Love You video, then Dr. Hook on German TV is the most fucked that any band has looked on film, I'm saying. It's extraordinary. Taylor's probably seen it.
I haven't, but I will.
You haven't? Oh, my God.
Yeah. Video playlist, everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, my favourite pictures, aside from Rupert Holmes looking like a photo fit that suddenly turned into quarter profile, is new music, bit of horseplay in the queue to audition as Manuel in the local rep touring production of Fawlty Towers. One of them's got an open hand held out under the other one's chin. And it looks like he's saying, are you chewing, boy? Spit out that gum. And on Azimuth's slide on the chart rundown, you can't really see what's going on. It's a live picture, bit of a mess. You just see half of a much too big drum kit and a musician sat on a high stool. And everything's too fuzzy to see what he's playing, but it's not a piano, so get off the fucking stool.
Yeah,
you look like you're waiting for a roadie to walk on and feed you Cowangate mashed banana pudding on a plastic spoon, and then give you massive backhanded slaps around the head when he thinks no one's looking. Rolls Royce, nine-piece band. Just laughing at Fiddler's Dram and waving handfuls of banknotes at him derisively. And a lovely shot of Sheila B. Devotion. That looks like, as it's listed, there's some confusions, but I'm sure we'll come to later.
We will.
Sheila and B. Devotion, more correct.
Yeah.
Looks like someone's pressed pause 2 seconds before John Holmes walked into the shop anyway. It's that lovely aesthetic, that sort of like, you know, that Boogie Nights aesthetic, glossy and healthy on the beach before you die at 34 in mysterious circumstances. Not that this happened to Sheila, thank the Lord.
I mean, I've got Matchbox, who look like the rapists in Deliverance at a Works dinner dance.
They are scary as fuck. Yeah.
Richard Jobson of the Skids in a yellow jogging suit, which makes him look like Hyacinth Bouquet on a fun run for the local church. And Fiddler's Drum, they do look like a shoot football team centre spread photo from the 1534/5 season.
And like overpopulated bands, right? You've got Rolls Royce with 9, Fiddler's Drum with 12. Even Dollar. There's 5 members of Dollar. Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew? David Van Day looks like he's got a bum fluff moustache as well in the photo. Which
God.
The weirdest thing about this chart rundown, though, is when you get to number 2, Billy Preston and Cy Rita, their name written in a different type to everybody else. Why?
Didn't notice that.
The only possible explanation I can think of is that somebody spelt Cyrita wrong and they had to change it at the last minute.
Called him Billy Preston and Ryvita.
Yeah, well, but such trifles had never bothered them before. We've seen misspelt band names on there.
Yeah.
And secondly, if they were capable of putting new letters on a slide, why would they not have access to the usual letter set?
Yeah.
A mystery for the ages.
So the following week, Jazz Carnival dropped three places to number 22, and they were never reacquainted with the UK charts again. But it sold over 500,000 copies worldwide, which set them up as a regular fixture on the international jazz festival circuit, and they split up for the first time in 1987.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All of television history is contained in the Box of Delights.
I've climbed up Nelson's column once before. These are small.
And put it down in front of Bagpuss.
I'm Julia Rayside. Join me and my guests as we dip into our favourite TV memories.
Boys mustn't hesitate, bash my head like this.
You can't tell me what to do, you ain't my mother!
I love when a plan comes together.
Come and tell us what yours are too.
We've all been told we can't discuss nominations.
It's a bit of car air.
Shut up with a novel on the top.
I think I like you, Lovejoy.
Find us on Twitter at Box Delights Pod and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Immediately fade into the backdrop of the next act, bearing the band name in a non-Moore Aventis digital watch font. It's The Plastic Age by The Buggles. Formed in Wimbledon in 1977, The Buggles consisted of Jeff Downes, the former keyboard player of the mid-70s jazz fusion band She's French, who had turned down a position in Wizard, and Trevor Horn, a former Bob Dylan tribute act from Durham, who moved to London in the early 70s to help re-record top 20 hits for BBC Radio, which still had restrictions on needle time, and playing in the orchestra for Come Dancing. They linked up in 1976 when Downes joined Horn and his then-girlfriend Tina Charles in a covers band called Northern Lights, later becoming members of her backing band when she became a solo artist while arsing about in assorted side projects. They'd already recorded their first single, Video Killed the Radio Star, in 1978, above a stonemasons in Wimbledon, but they didn't land a record deal until 1979 with Island, and it took 5 weeks to knock Message in a Bottle off number one, spending a week there before giving way to Lena Martell. This is the follow-up and the second cut from their debut album, The Age of Plastic, which came out a fortnight ago. It's a new entry this week at number 54, and here they are in the studio.
Yeah.
The main takeaway from that potted history is Trevor Horn was Tina Charles's baby who just loves to dance, who wants to dance, who loves to dance, who's got to dance. That changes everything for me now.
I interviewed Trevor Horn and asked him about this. He's not on the record, sadly. He was just in the live band. But still, you know, right. You know, great bit of great introduction to pop history to be part of Tina Charles' backing band.
Hooked him up with Bidu and all them lot.
Well, that's it, yeah. Which, you know, probably put me in good stead for production stuff, I would imagine. Mm. I went to see the Buggles once. He did a kind of charity gig in, maybe up 10 years ago now, in what used to be called Subterranea, maybe is now called Subterranea again, in Ladbroke Grove, underneath the Westway. And there were lots of guest stars, people like... Gary Barlow and Richard O'Brien from the Rocky Horror Show and all these kind of people. And they did Video Killed the Radio Star 7 times in the gig.
No. Yeah. No.
Seriously. Yeah. because they did the album The Age of Plastic, and which of course has the song on it, but basically all the crowd wanted to hear was that song. And they had a local children's choir joined them for one rendition of it, and I think Richard O'Brien for one, and Gary Barlow for, and they literally did the song 7 times. So
fucking hell.
Yeah, if any band has milked their hit more than that, I'd love to know about it.
God, did you shout "Do Video Kill the Radio Star" at the end, Simon?
Yeah,
I would have
exactly.
done.
Yeah.
Buggles currently tussling with new music for the electronic nerd pop crown, and they're certainly winning commercially.
Yes.
Artistically, I'm not sure who comes out on top. New Music had better tunes, but Buggles were more full on, you know, robot waiter, gross out, pseudo plastic. I say pseudo plastic because, of course, they were old musos, really, you know, just having fun. And there was never anything simply celebratory about the futuristic blankness of Buggles music. When you listen to it, it's always a bit regretful, you know, pining for the past. It's like a satire of ultra modernity, sort of bittersweet at best. And it's, to me, it's quite funny how this record is trying really hard to sound modern and bleepy and not like late period Yes, which it keeps threatening to lurch into. And then suddenly it reaches that bridge section and the lid blows off and it starts going for the one. Like he can't help himself, because that's what he is musically, Trevor Horn, which is why he's a better producer than artist. You apply all that skill and all that bombast to some decent pop music and the result can be phenomenal. But, you know, when the source of that technical wizardry is in charge from top to bottom, you might not get what you need. And I quite love this record. And he has been involved in the songwriting and performance of some great pop music. But, you know, most often the good stuff happens when someone a bit fresher and perhaps dumber comes up with the meat and he goes off and cooks it, you know. I mean, it's a good record, this, but it sounds like a project, whereas the best records he was involved with sound like events, which is just something he couldn't do on his own.
Yeah, that Yes bit, and I know the bit you're talking about, is that they send the heart police to put you under cardiac arrest.
Like John Anderson, like John
Anderson. Yeah, exactly. You can totally imagine John Anderson singing that bit. And it struck me as that, like, coupled with the fact that Jeff Downes has 4 keyboards on the go, right? It struck me as what amounts to, in football, they call it a come and get me plea, right? there'd be a post-TOTP interview, and Trevor Horn would say, obviously, I have a great deal of admiration for Yes, but I'm fully committed to the Buggles at the moment, and I'm just taking each single as it comes.
Yeah, want-away musician.
Yeah, exactly.
There's some controversy when he likes a post on Twitter showing him photoshopped into the current Yes lineup.
Yeah. So, you know, while us pop kids were thinking the Buggles were part of the new wave, the remnants of a much older wave watching with evil intent. I mean, I've got a bit H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, Jeff Wayne's version anyway, but you can imagine a kind of Richard Burton voiceover. No one would have believed in the first years of the 1980s that chart pop affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of prog. No one would have dreamed that synth bands were being scrutinised as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of a Yes revival involving the fucking Buggles. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded Top of the Pops with envious eyes. Slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us. Yeah. And the lyrics, right? Taylor's right about the ambivalence of whether it likes the future or doesn't like the future.
Mm.
But the bit that jumped out at me is the first lines, every day my metal friend shakes my bed at 6 a.m. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, if you will live in a house share with Cradle of Filth fans, what do you expect? All right, yeah, tumbleweed, all right, fair.
Yeah. Shakes my bed at 6 a.m. and there's Mike Reed's cock tied to the end of it.
The worst lyrics, though, is in that bit where he says, yeah, they send the heart police to put you under cardiac arrest. Yeah, very nice. Doesn't mean anything. It's just an empty pun. I hate it. It's like, you might as well say, they send the bear police to put you in a panda car. It's like, it's very good. That. It's not. It doesn't mean anything at all.
Of all the things it's scared of with the future, it's weird that heart attacks seem to be the preeminent one, because heart attacks are, you know, as old as time. And he just seems to think that cardiac arrest is somehow this terrible thing that the 1980s is going to bring. You know, I mean, the whole thing is this kind of sub Alvin Toffler future shock stuff about artificial intelligence and plastic surgery. But the main obsession is heart attacks. I don't really get it.
You'd think, if anything, they would become less frequent as technology marches on.
But I did like this record. I liked it at the time, and I can prove it because the copy of it I've got is clearly one that I bought at the time. Because I don't know if you remember these. There are these Panini stickers, like similar to the football ones, of pop music that came out for a while. And I collected them. I never got enough of them to fill a book. In fact, I don't even think I had the book. But I just used to put them on the cut-out sleeves of whatever records I owned by that artist. And I've still got my copy of Living in the Plastic Age in an Island Records sleeve with that sticker on it. But the sticker's slightly too big, so I've had to sort of tuck the corner of it, fold it round the middle, you know, the circle in the middle.
We didn't get that in Nottingham, I don't think. I've got no recollection of that, come to think of it. What we had, even then, even in 1980, there was an ice cream van. And it still had in the window by the serving hatch, buy a screwball and get a Mirabelle sticker of your favourite pop star. And it was David Cassidy and Donny Osmond and the Bay Street
Rollers. Way out of date then.
Still,
couldn't
have been bothered to take it down.
Fucking
and
hell.
I always wanted to ask just out of interest, but I thought, no, I'll lose all street credibility if I stand on this street with loads of kids behind me asking for a David Cassidy sticker.
Yeah, well, it's like in 1980, 81, 82, whenever there was, like, on a birthday card or something, if there was, like, a drawing of a pop star and he's still got stack heels and glitter stars on him and a big guitar.
Usually
an acoustic guitar for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, they looked like the band Child, if you remember them. That's what they would look like.
See, I do remember this from the time, but I don't remember having any reaction to it at all, right? To me, this was a bit of a non-event. It was a bit underwhelming after their last Playground smash, you know.
Video Killed the Radio Star was just as innovative as Our Friends Electric. They were of a pair to me.
Yeah.
And looking back now, you just think, why the fuck did you think that, you twat?
No, it's a great record.
It was a great record. I bought it. You know, that was one of my number one singles that I had to buy that week. But with this one, I mean, you could say that the pressure's on for the Buggles here.
It's the underwhelming follow-up, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's the underwhelming follow-up, which is a classic thing in pop history, really.
Yeah.
And then there was like Clean and L Street. And I think, I don't know the chart positions off the top of my head, I'm sure you do, but I reckon it's a sort of a perfect downward curve, probably, for them.
Yes.
Yeah.
The term diminishing returns was made for the Buggles' career.
But the thing about this, it's like, just because it's got a simple riff, like out of a ZX Spectrum game, you know, that do-do-do-do-do-do-do, it doesn't mean it's doesn't mean it's commercial, you know. It's really, it's a producer's record, sort of in the wrong way, in that it's like it's all sound and feel and concept, like posing as a pop song, you know. But it's sort of, in a way, it can't really commit. It's like, I'm really unimpressed by the hook line where he says, this could be the Plastic Age. It just sounds a bit weak. Mm. Don't speculate. Declare. Yeah. This is the... If Sir Jimmy Savile, OBE, KCSG, had said, this could be the age of the train,
yeah,
he wouldn't be where he is today.
No.
And this is not just a pale successor to Video Killed the Radio Star. It's a pale precursor to their best record, for my money, which is Elstree, which is the one which really shows how a song and a record can be totally cerebral and conceptual and clever and a bit of a put-on, but also gorgeous and poignant and genuine. And to me, that one also, it does a better job of straddling that comic futurism and authentic nostalgia. Much better than this one. As good as Video Killed the Radio Star. But whatever anyone thinks of the Buggles, I would say it's a clear sign of how open and unrestrictive the pop scene of 1980 really was. That anyone could consider this an acceptable look and sound and general aesthetic for a hit group, you know. Whereas in fact, straight into looking, no problem. And I mean, they weren't a hit group for very long because they're not the kind of band that builds a following. And they also were not a churning hit factory, but they sort of weren't a novelty band or an obvious one-hit wonder band either. Mm. They were just this. They were like just an odd arrangement of unphotogenic men in bad clothes that don't really go together, looking like the sort of Aventis geeks you might see on Making the Most of the Micro. You know, talking about sending electronic messages by computer, but except they're dressed up for a play in their village hall for which they've done all the music on a synthesizer.
I don't know though. You say bad clothes, but the guitarist has got this amazing quilted silver jacket that I would wear the shit out of, possibly along with Mike Reed's chessboard shirt.
I feel bad for him though. He looks like the impossible offspring of Peter Duncan and shamed comedy actor Chris Lagham, but he's. He has his moment stolen. He's got a mic set up, right? And he mimes that vocode a bit near the beginning where it goes, hello. And that should have been his big star turn, you know, his novelty cameo. You should have got a big close-up of his face going, hello, like Steve Priest, you know. But in fact, what happens is the camera at that point is zooming in on Trevor Horn and removing him from the shot. And then to make it worse, Trevor lives up to his name and horns in on his bit.
Oh, fuck's sake.
And he mimes it himself. Nice. And on such moments, careers can turn, you know. No one ever heard of that guy again, Paul.
He didn't get headhunted by Yes.
Well,
no. I don't think, no.
Oh, and did you notice the drummer?
No.
It's our old friend Richard Burgess, who was last seen in Driver 67, who is currently working on Landscape's debut LP.
No way.
Don't you know, right. Yes.
Blimey.
Yeah. I was just distracted by, what's his name, Downs' seemingly homemade green flash jogging suit, which he's chosen to wear with a Baco foil wind cheater, which is, you know, a dystopian vision of a never-occurring future, just as unsettling as the one in Metropolis.
The next week, the Plastic Age entered the top 40 at number 35 and would take 4 weeks to get to number 16, its highest position. However, a few months later, the Buggles were commencing work on their second LP when another band were in the studio next door. Yes, who were one of Horn's favourite bands and were also under the wing of their new manager. And after Horn bunged over a song for them to record, him and Downs were invited to replace John Anderson and Rick Wakeman, so they did that instead. In the meantime, Ireland would put out the follow-up Clean Clean, which would only get to number 38 for 2 weeks in April of this year, and they would close out 1980 with Elstree, which straggled up to number 55 in November. After Yes disbanded in the same month, they returned to London to get on with the second Buggles LP, but Downes walked out on the very first day of recording, as he'd been invited by Steve Howe to form the band Asia with Carl Palmer and John Wetton of King Crimson. So Horn started messing about with a Fairlight, finished it off himself, said fuck this for a game of soldiers, and went on to be the production overlord of the 80s.
Buggles on the Plastic Age, the follow-up to Video Kill the Radio Star. The Nolans once had the doubtful pleasure of having me sing with them around a piano. Fortunately, it hasn't stopped them. They're up there this week at number four.
Camera pans back from the stage to reveal Reed standing behind the kids as he reminds us that he's a musician too, you know, before handing off to a video of I'm in the Mood for Dancing by the Nolans. We've discussed the Nolan sisters many a time and oft, and this is their 11th single. It's the follow-up to Spirit, Body and Soul, which was their first chart single in the UK after 5 years of flopperage, and it was rushed out the week after the previous single peaked at number 34 in October of 1979. After stalling at number 73 for 2 weeks, it suddenly soared 33 places to number 40, then soared another 20 places the week after, and this week it's nipped up 2 places from number 6 to number 4. Oh, more red-hot Nolan action.
Al, I've got a complaint to make. I think you're trolling me here. I really do.
No.
Right? Yeah, because this, right, this is the third time we've done the Nolans, right? Because I was on episodes 34 and 42 when we also did the Nolans.
Yeah.
And it still hasn't been the good song. The good song, of
mate.
Course, the good song is Don't Make Waves, which is a sort of Irish Catholic, Kay's catalogue-clad take on George McRae's Rock Your Baby. And I absolutely love it. And the fact that we still haven't done it is making me think that you're deliberately choosing all the shit ones with your episode choices.
I'm edging you, you're saying.
You are. Right, yeah. And right, here's the thing with the Nolans, right? We often use the word mum disco on chart music, right?
Not only to describe, we will again.
Yeah, not only to describe the Nolans, but people like Tina Charles and Liquid Gold, Kelly Marie, the Doolies without Ghoulies, that is. All that stuff. and I'm in the Mood for Dancing is very much the rock around the clock of mum disco, in that it didn't launch the genre, but it crystallised it in such a commercially successful way that it became the defining anthem of mum disco.
I'll go further on that one, Simon. I contend that if Saturday Night Fever was actually about John Travolta's Mam, this would be the Staying Alive.
Yeah.
You would get an opening shot of this film of a swinging Fine Fair carrier bag and Neris Hughes sauntering down the high street.
Neris Hughes, perfect. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But you see, you know, someone talking to me about I'm in the Mood for Dancing in relation to the Nolans is a bit like someone saying, oh yeah, Dexys, the band who did Come On Eileen, or Soft Cell, the band who did Tainted Love. And I just grumble, fuck that. What about This Is What She's Like, or Sex Dwarf, or in the Nolans case, Don't Make Waves. Anyway, that's my complaint over and done with.
Yeah, disco, in this case, being short for discomfort. I think I've previously outlined my theory that the creepiness of a pop group increases exponentially with each sibling in the lineup. And sure enough, there's something faintly troubling about the Nolan sisters to me. It's like a panzer division of cloned Philistine Littlewood shop assistants, just rolling over all delicacy and detail and human creativity and combining this absence of wit and self-awareness with the inflexible clannishness and force and solidarity of the large family. That gives me a chill. It could be partly because I'm an only child and adopted at that, but I always feel a bit disturbed and discomforted by the thickness of blood. Do you know what I mean? So almost perceive it as a threat to individuality. I mean, obviously people have a strong link to their parents and their own children. But beyond that, it gets gradually scarier as you move along the branches of the family tree. Now, I'm well aware this might be my own poorly adjusted problem, but seeing all these Nolans marching towards you as one, flattening the landscape, you know, loud and not listening, maybe others can share a little of my trepidation. It's that quasi-fascistic thing about family. Do you know what I mean? Why? Just because. It's family, isn't it? My family, right or wrong. You know, blood, if not soil. Don't know, don't like it. Good to see this clip, though, if just as an explanation for the world jumpsuit shortage.
Yes.
The Nolans are not the Nolans without saggy jumpsuits and kitten heels. It's, I believe jumpsuits are back on the high street these days, but some genius has managed to make them look not like what a clown wears. So progress rolls on. But you see the Nolans standing in a line here, and surely any woman immediately thinks, okay, that's a nightclub toilet queue that's going to take a really long time to go down. And also, why am I in this nightclub? constantly being offered baby shams by engaged glaziers with police moustaches, you know. Researchers for Blind Date just driving through the middle of the dance floor in a flatbed truck, just hurling people off the back.
I mean, they've gone for deliberately unmatching evening wear here, haven't they? It looks as if they've actually bagsed different pages of the Kay's catalogue this time.
Yeah.
They're trying to strike out on their own.
Yeah, it's almost as if it wasn't coordinated, as if they just rang each other up individually one evening, said, I'm in the mood for dancing. Are you in the mood? Yeah, I'm in the mood for dancing as well. Yeah, yeah, let's see what Bernadette thinks. Oh, yeah, she's in the mood for dancing. Yeah. And they're all wearing different outfits. Yeah, yeah. Because even their dancing isn't coordinated. I notice there's a moment where Colleen almost collides with Kenina, whatever her name is. You know. Which surprised me, given, you know, you'd expect at least from what Taylor was saying, some kind of fascistic discipline to the way they move. The other thing about the way they move, there's a couple of things that kind of upset me. It's the dainty way that Bernie holds her microphone sideways between her fingers, like almost like Groucho Marx about to twiddle his cigar. I hate that way of holding a microphone. And then there's a bit near the end where, I don't know if you clocked this, she sort of gets down for what's almost a slut drop, like grinding her crotch, which is just all kinds of wrong for the Nolans.
I mean, the Nolans are obviously very low-hanging fruit, to say the least. And I mean, there's not much to be gained from us sitting here saying that their music isn't really very good, or, you know, maybe they didn't look especially classy. But there is something sort of interesting about the pitch of this particular horror, you know, and the fact that this is probably the last these are the last years when this kind of club act was part of the mainstream music scene, right? Like people who advertise their albums on TV rather than in music papers.
Yeah.
And there'd be 20 tracks on their album. I mean, club comics were still getting TV work into the 90s. Right? Little and Large still had a primetime Saturday night BBC One show in 1991. And other variety acts, you know, could still find a place in the big time for a while. But the early 80s was really the last call for this sort of wheel tappers and shunters type turn.
Black Lace were one, I think. Black Lace.
I guess, you know, yeah.
The last one.
When did they get under the wire? 84, was it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, after that, you had to be a TV star already, like that cruise ship singing woman. You know what I mean? It's like, it was a kind of novelty. But yeah, any traffic then was in the other direction. and ex-hit singers would vanish into nostalgia cabaret, you know, or eventually tumbling all the way down to sort of Phoenix Nights level, you know, until even that dried up, because it's cheaper and it's better for the bar takings to just book, you know, Dean Spunk presents a tribute to Ollie Murs. And, you know, but that gap in the charts was filled by more professional stuff, like from America, like Cher and things like that, you know, sort of stepped into that hole. But I don't know, it never fully compensated for the loss of something horrible but unique, you know, that sort of nasty British or Anglo-Irish variety tradition. Just gone forever.
So, yeah, they've already done this in the Top of the Pop studio late last month, and there's a perfectly serviceable video knocking about, but in this case, we're treated to a live performance with a full orchestra, and it's been doing my head where it's come from. We all know that the Nolan sisters were BBC people, so it could be anything, and I thought, oh, it looks a bit Seaside Special, but obviously it's not, because it's January. So it may be a filming from the Radio 2 series of Tuesday Night is Gala Night from the 18th of December, which came from the Golders Green Hippodrome, and that's the Jeff Love Orchestra there, right, if that's the case. And it's hosted by Terry Wogan, because, hey, it's Radio 2 in the Aventis.
Whoever it is, the hats off to the bass player. He's having a great time there, bubbling away, just really animating this blasted deathscape. It's quite impressive.
Mm.
What this makes me want to watch again, actually, is the opening night of Sound TV, originally to be called the Great British Television Channel, but eventually went out of Sound TV, which was the amusingly short-lived satellite channel set up in 2005, I think, by Richard Digents, Chris Tarrant, ex-Copycats superstar Mike Osman, and Jethro, the Cornish comedian, breeder and West Country landowner, which was meant to be a haven for good old-fashioned variety acts and up-and-coming talents, right, who couldn't get past the North London metropolitan liberal elite gatekeepers at the BB, so-called, see. and anyone with a taste for hardcore British rubbish and the sour end of real life Partridge really should watch this. Their launch night. It's all on YouTube, right? As should anyone who thinks Brexit came out of nowhere. they start off showing you previews, right, of some of the stuff that's going to be coming up on Sound TV. Some of the delights they've got in store, which is like sailing down the River Styx on a raft made out of rancid gammon. And then after a taped message from Chris Tarrant, who mysteriously couldn't be there, the first programme is just Richard Digents, Mike Osman and Jethro sat around a table in some like noisy restaurant in Southampton where they're having their launch party with a pretend bottle of champagne in a bucket in front of them. No glasses, no, you know. Without a script, just fucking chuntering on and on and on about how they're such heroes for bringing all this great British talent to the great British public, and how all these out-of-touch TV executives don't understand what people want, and they're going to give a break to all these Joe Beasley and Cheeky Monkey-type club acts, you know. And it's amazing in itself, like, just for being the worst TV you've ever seen in your life, but also, it's the fascinating arrogance of these people, right? That they live in a tiny world, but they're the centre of attention wherever they go. So they assume that they're the centre of the world. And it goes on and it goes on. And they're following their stream of consciousness. And over the course of this hour, they gradually start to sound more and more bitter. And it all starts to come out. And it's less and less about how great their new channel is, and more about how they're not on proper television anymore. and this is the launch spectacular. like going out live, like firing their brand new channel into an overcrowded market. Just three snarling old cunts who've never forgiven Tony Ayres, you know, indulging themselves via satellite. It's really something you need to see. But it's... Oh, and the channel lasted about 6 months, by the way.
Of course it did.
Nobody watched it.
As long as that.
Yeah, and they all fell out. But the thing is, that is the inevitable end point of the culture that we see blooming here in this Nolan's clip, because it's a dead-end culture. And dead-end culture is always tainted with the smell of death. And once you smell that, you can't ignore it, you know. And I've never felt that sentimental warmth, you know, towards end of the pier shows or Working Man's Club turns, you know, not really. I mean, I'd rather have that than another braying toff on Live at the Apollo, you know, doing trying to get applause breaks by talking about Brexit and stuff. But I remember growing up around this stuff, this sort of tatty variety, and just at the time thinking, fucking hell, we can do better than this. We're not all savages.
I mean, they claim they're in the mood for dancing, but really they go no further than a bit of twirling around and then an awkward bit of twisting and some Andrew's sister's arm gestures.
Yeah.
I'm feeling obliged to dance.
Simon, is Colleen Nolan the one you fancy?
Yeah.
Okay, right. Alas, we can't pretend this didn't happen, right? I only found this out recently.
I found this out 5 minutes ago.
You know exactly what I'm going to say.
I'm shocked that it's not come out.
At the unfortunate age of 13, she released a solo single called Andy about her presumably imaginary love affair with Prince Andrew.
Oh, my God.
It goes, I wouldn't swap my Jubilee poster for all the David Souls in the world, which is... one or two if you count Kid Jensen. Says, you are my super prince. I've loved you ever since I first set eyes on you. It's very touching. It's just the simple heartwarming story of the love between an untouchably privileged and powerful man and an innocent underage girl. It's a true fairy tale.
Fucking hell.
Yeah.
It would have made him break out into embarrassed sweat, except he's unable to do that, of course.
Yeah. Well, Colleen's fantasies of this better and more glamorous life know no bounds, because she sings, you come to my house, I go to your house, we spend the evening watching TV.
then we go to Pizza Express. Yay!
Look out for that stench of uncontrollable sweat moving closer and closer through part two of Emmerdale Farm.
Fucking
hell. So offer him a packet of Tato crisps and a glass of red lemonade and hope that incapacitates him. He's not going to marry you anyway, you're Catholic.
So the following week, I'm in the mood for dancing, stayed at number four, but then dragged itself up to number three, where it stayed for 2 weeks. The follow-up, Don't Make Waves, would get to number 12 in May, and they'd have a number 9 with Gotta Pull Myself Together in October, and a number 12 with Who's Gonna Rock You in January of 1981. On that bombshell, we're going to leave it for now, Pop Craze Youngsters. Come and join us in a bit for part three of this episode of Chart Music. On behalf of Taylor Parks and Simon Price, my name's Al Needham. Stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.